This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hi, this is Dave Musial, owner of Four Seasons Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electric. With our biggest sale ever, furnaces from $39 a month, furnace and air conditioning combos from $59 a month, plus 72 months interest-free financing and up to a $4,000 system rebate. Four Seasons guaranteed to beat any competitor's price by up to $1,000 guaranteed. So call today for your free in-home estimate and same-day installation.
For all the right reasons, call 866-4SEASONS.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
I'm going to tell you what, every Friday we have a guy, JR, on from Taking Vegas, and he gives us a free on-air pick, and they're starting to look at me sideways at the sportbook where I do my business because I take his pick and I make a sizable wager, and I've been there like 4 weeks in a row with winning tickets, and the same lady is starting to look at me like, what's going on here? Stephen Melnick joins us now, our friend, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State, where he's done research in the strategic supply chain, cybersecurity, performance measurements, and supply chain design. We normally talk about EVs, and we will a little bit today, but we're going to talk about tariffs and supply chains and all that stuff. How you doing, Professor?
Not bad. How about yourself?
I'm all right. You ever watch the show The Office?
Not really. Let's put it this way. Recently, I've been kind of busy. I've been involved in the CHIPS Act. I've been involved in a major project on that, and that's been taking up my time.
I got a lot of free time, and the only reason I mention that, there's an episode where one of the characters is talking about having a vasectomy and then having it reversed and then having it again and having it reversed, and he says, snip, snap, snip, snap, snip, snap. That's the feeling I get with these tariffs. I don't quite understand how you can practically put on a tariff, take it off, put it on, take it off, raise it. Take me through the process of tariffing before we talk about results, please.
Okay, basically a tariff is a tax. Let's be honest. What you're doing is saying that something that comes in from Canada or Mexico is going to be taxed, and somebody's going to have to pay for it. The concept is the one that often people think of is that the company who is bringing in the product pays it, but ultimately it's going to come back to the consumer. And in many cases, it's also going to impact how supply chains are developed. So imagine that a tariff is a tax. Anything you buy from Canada, anything you buy from the United States, guess what? We're going to take the price and add 25% to it.
But I guess the question I had is, what happens? Who institutes this tariff? Because the president says, all right, that's it. I'm putting a tariff on you. Okay, I'm taking it off. I'm putting it on again. I'm taking it off. Is somebody filling out a form? And I'm not trying to be stupid about this, Professor. And by the way, I want to open this up for the audience as well at 504-260-1870. Go ahead.
Well, what you've got is something that's occurring right now, which is the president's actions by putting them on and taking them off, putting them on, they're creating a lot of uncertainty, a lot of confusion. And this confusion has resulted in companies not knowing what to do. If you're a company like Ford or GM or Stellantis or Toyota, any of the companies, you're going to find out that this is creating problems because you've got to think about how to respond. You've got to think about where to put your production. You've got to think about how this is going to impact prices. You also have to think about issues of how long. For example, if the tariff is just a minor spat, that is, Trump is upset with Canada and Mexico, and he puts it on for, let's say, a month, we're not going to be that bad. Most auto industry companies will have enough slack in the form of inventory in the pipeline. They can take care of it. But if it's going to be more than a month, then you've got an issue of how do you price cars? And that's going to be a major issue because right now people are complaining about the price of cars. And it's not only going to affect the price of new cars, it's going to affect the price of used cars. Not only that, it's going to distract us from preparing for China. And China's out there with its EVs. It's basically ready to come into our market. And on top of that, what people, even beyond the auto industry, the tariffs are going to impact other industries. And they're also impacting how other areas are responding. Doug Ford, who's the premier of Ontario, he simply said, guess what? I'm going to put a 25% tariff on all energy going to the United States. I'm going to take off all liquor that is produced in the red states. And the American government came back and said, well, we took off the tariffs. And his attitude was, no, let's get this resolved. So it's going to do that. And finally, it's also going to affect things like, are you ready for this? The defense industry.
So let me go back one second. And I don't want to waste a lot of time on this, but just for my own edification, Professor. If a tariff goes on, at what point do you decide what goods and then comes off, what goods are tariffed and what aren't? Because, well, wait a minute, okay. This crossed the line at this point and this didn't. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because stuff doesn't these are forces of law, right?
Yeah, not only that, but it's really complex. Let me give you an example. 2017, Bloomberg does a study. And what they were trying to do is understand the supply chain in the auto industry. And something as simple as one single electronic component in a circuit board, one of the most simplest items, it goes into a car seat. Mm-hmm. They found out that it crosses the border between Canada, the United States, and Mexico four times.
Really?
So the
to get worked on and then revised and then worked on again, or different pieces
exactly.
added to it?
Exactly.
Okay.
And in some cases, you've got some major components across the border up to eight times. So what you've got now is a really interesting question. When do we tariff it? Do we tariff it every time it comes into the United States? In which case, you've got this simple component, you've got an existing supply chain, and it's going to cross the border four times. So you basically tariffed it four times. So it's not simply 25% once, it's 25% once, it comes back, gets shipped out, gets tariffed. And so now this is becoming complex. And so one of the major problems car companies are trying to figure out is, what's this going to do to the price of our product? And this is an issue at a time when most customers are complaining about the price of a car. As of January of this year, a new car average price is $48,118. A used car is $24,402. People are, I've been looking at various estimates, and they're expecting if the tariff lasts over 2 months, they expect a 5 to 10% increase in price, which means car prices may go up as much as $12,000.
Okay, let me slow down a little bit here because I'm trying to keep track of all of this. I never thought I'd say it, but I am going to say it because it seems like something my father would have said. But you say the average price of a new car is $48,000. First house I bought was $53,000. So I guess that goes to show you how crazy it's getting. And then you're talking about financing for 8 years. But when it goes to building, let me get the audience in here too, Professor. We're going to have to go in a nonlinear way if we can, because I want to get everybody's questions answered. How is it collected and by whom? Talking about a tariff.
Okay. Basically, it's every time it's comes in, the mechanics depend, but I think every time it comes in, the government's going to simply track the number of times it comes into the states, and it's going to say if it comes from Canada, you have to pay the price, you have to pay 25% of that price to us because you bought it from Canada. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be collected by the government.
Okay.
It could be collected at the border, or it could be collected, tracked at the border, because a lot of trucks coming across the border from Canada, Mexico, come in under CT PATH, which is basically an expedited system of crossing the border. And they're tracked. So every time they come in, we have a manifest. We take a look at the value, and the government sends you a bill and says, okay, you bought X number of thousands of dollars of parts. Here's your bill. Pay us.
So when it comes to passing that along to the consumer, and that's where I think people get get confused.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Take that. Take me through that, Professor, if you can. Okay. And when it comes to pricing an object and price point, the cost of that going in, who's going to pay for the tariff? Go ahead.
Okay. First of all, in order to understand this, let's understand one thing. I'm going to take you back a step because in order to understand how it affects pricing, somebody in your audience is going to say, well, can't we resource production from Mexico and Canada to the United States? No. It takes years to develop a supply chain relationship. I was talking with one company that's buying basically something simple, high-grade surgical stainless steel. Mm-hmm. And this is for a DOD application, Department of Defense, and they told me that if their supplier left, it would take them up to 2 years to identify, to evaluate, to integrate, and to educate the supplier and get them into their supply chain. It takes time. So what you've got going on is you've got a system which has evolved over 60 years. It's based on comparative advantage. For example, a lot of the assembly work is done in Mexico. Why? Wages are lower there. And so what's going to happen there is as we look at it, we're going to start to see that it becomes difficult. And it becomes difficult in order to, you've got all these relationships, you've got more than transactions, you've got relationships. The suppliers get to know you. So you've got all of this present, and suddenly you're going to say, okay, you've got a month to change this. This is a system that's built over 60 years. You know, if you've worked with someone for a period of time, is there a value to that? Yeah. If you work with a company, do you have a doctor that you go to on a regular basis?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Why?
Because I know I'm going to trust him.
So he or she gets to know you, and over time, they get to identify things, and so there's a value of a relationship. So when we start thinking about reshoring things back to the States, number one, you've got to think about, do you have adequate capacity? Number two, do you have the capabilities? Number three, can you integrate them? And number four, can you build the relationship? And those are not trivial issues. So we've got an existing system built over 60 years. They're fairly complex. The average car, you can get up to 30,000 individual components going into a car. Mm. Some of them come from Mexico. Some of them come from from Canada. So all of those things are coming together, and suddenly you've got to reshore that without disrupting existing supply.
Let me take a quick break, Professor. We're going to pick this up when we come back. 504-260-1870. If you have any questions about tariffs or about supply chains, Professor Stephen Melnick is our friend, a professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. And I learned this lesson a long time ago with a restaurant supply place and stainless steel mixing bowls, of all things. At that point, this had to be 10 years ago, you could get a stainless steel mixing bowl from China, and I just remember stainless steel for whatever reason, for like $3. You could also buy one that was made in America for $24. I'm a consumer that is money cognizant, so I chose the one from China, and that goes to tariffs and manufacturing in the United States and company-subsidized labor in other government-subsidized labor in other countries, and can the U.S.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you. From daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it. That's why I go for a 5-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or whenever my favorite team is playing late. 5-hour energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before tip-off.
The Women's Hoop Show, a podcast hosted by me, Jordan Robinson, brings you fresh women's basketball voices and breakdowns every week. I'll be joined by hoop experts all year long. Find the Women's Hoop Show on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Really compete, and if so, at what cost? We'll pick it up with Professor Melnick when we come back. 504-260-1870. We're talking tariffs on WWL. 927, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking about tariffs with Stephen Melnick, a professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. And, Professor, what did you say you've been working on lately, as I asked you about watching
working,
a stupid TV
I've been
program?
Working on a I've been working on a project with due to the CHIPS Act. What we're doing is trying to accelerate the development, establishment and development of microelectronic clusters within the United States. And last week at this time, I was in Rochester, New York, mm-hmm. where we were reviewing the progress of our first round of awards. So I've been involved in that. And before we go any further, I just want to answer a question sure. that you asked earlier. What's the process by which a tariff is collected? Mm-hmm. Well, the process is when someone crosses the border, CBP, which stands for U.S. Customs and Border Protection, mm-hmm. they will essentially have the importers, the trucks, whatever, classify and declare the value and quantity of the goods. CBP, which is Customs and Border Protection, will then review the paperwork, perform an audit where appropriate. Then they're going to collect the tariffs, penalties, and administrative fees, and then they will deposit those revenues into the U.S. General Fund. That's the process. So that means every time, if you look at this, you cross the border, potentially a tariff can be collected. That's why the issue I brought up to you before, if a product goes back and forth across the border, in the case of a simple little component into a assembly, which is used to control your seat, goes four times, does that mean that you tariff that item four times? In which case, it becomes an absolute nightmare for the auto industry.
Let me get to this, if I may. President Trump himself saying, and I think this goes to a difference between then and now. He said, we were at our richest from 1870 to 1913. That's when we were a tariff country. And then they went to an income tax concept. It's fine. It's okay. But it would have been very much better. And I think that goes to, at that time, tariffs were a source of revenue for the government, not necessarily a way to protect manufacturers, right? Take me through that in the history of tariffs in the country.
You're right. There was a transition. The last president to really embrace tariffs was McKinley. And McKinley was ultimately shot, but towards the end of his life, before he was shot, he started to see that tariffs were really a revenue source. And President Trump, with all due respect, I would argue that the richest the United States was from 1945 until about 1960. Mm-hmm. Because at that point, we were the manufacturing hub of the world. Europe was devastated. Japan was devastated. China was not a manufacturing country. The United States was basically the supplier to the world. This was the time when you saw a lot of things develop. Universities grew. You saw our incomes. It was a time in which many people saw their standard of living. It was a time in which most people could afford a house. It was a time when the United States became viewed as basically the savior of the world when it introduced the Marshall Plan, which essentially prevented Europe from falling into the hands of the communists. So I would argue that's really the golden heyday. I think Trump is focusing on that period because it's consistent with the narrative as he sees it. But if you look at the United States after World War II, and the United States in 1913, they were different. The industries were different. The respect was different. And the abilities were different. I don't think the United States of 1913 could have successfully fought the Second World War as it did.
Let me go to my stainless steel bowl example that I gave you before. This had to be 10, 15 years ago. I don't know if you heard me say it or not, but you know, I had stainless steel mixing bowls, right? And I'm a stainless steel kind of guy, Professor. I love stainless steel. My daddy did too. And I could get a bowl for $2.30 that was manufactured in China at that time, or I could spend $18-$20 for one made in the U.S. And I'll be honest, I bought the one made in China because, you know, I'm not independently wealthy. And that is, in microcosm, what we're talking about here, is it not?
Well, okay, you're getting into several things simultaneously.
Okay.
Let's kind of decouple things. The first thing that you're bringing up is the bowl that's coming into the United States that's at $3, mm-hmm. let's say, versus $18. Is it the same bowl? In some cases, you've got companies which will sell you something which looks the same but is of lower quality.
Okay.
The second issue that you're getting into is, why is China able to produce that bowl at $3 and bring it in while Americans can't? And so that brings up the issue of what's going on. If it's a case of dumping, which is the Chinese are coming into the United States and they're selling products at less than their fixed variable cost, then guess what? You have an avenue. That's when tariffs are justified because they're punitive.
Hang on one second, Professor. What is the object for the objective for the country that is dumping? What is their end goal here?
It's very simple. They want to get market share. And one way of getting market share is to produce a product at a far lower price and then drive out the existing competition. Once you drive out the existing competition, then you can jack the prices back up.
And that's no different, really, than Walmart does with small mom-and-pop groceries, is it?
Well, yeah, but it is. There are some differences. Walmart has a reputation for being very cost-driven.
Okay.
But Walmart has also realized that they need to take care of their supply chain. They don't do as good a job as Costco, but they need to take care of their supply chain, because if you drive a supplier out, you've got to replace that supplier. And that's a time-consuming process. It's an expensive process. And on the other hand, when you're dealing with suppliers, especially in the United States, you have to understand that it makes sense to have a supplier that you can depend on. And this is one reason why Walmart was one of the first companies to realize that many of their suppliers were small to medium-sized companies, 500 people or less. They had limited financial resources. And when they went out to borrow money so they could satisfy a Walmart contract, they wound up having to charge Walmart higher prices because they had to pay a higher interest rate. Walmart said, well, what if we worked with you and co-signed the loan? And that would drive down prices. And so Walmart was one of the first companies to tap into the power of what's known as supply chain finance. So be careful when you get into that, because in Walmart's case, you know, they are competing on low cost, but they don't want to be associated with anything that would seem to be negative, because many of their customers are employed by the very companies that they might be affecting. So
it may have been a bad comparison, but the end result, and I'm not trying to argue with the professor, you've forgotten more than I'll ever know about this, but when it comes to dumping or whatever, sometimes a large competitor can come in and maybe sell things at a loss to drive the small person out of the market. Then they go back to whatever they want to do. Accurate?
And that's a major issue, and that's, in fact, part of the major concerns that you see in industry, which is that there's an unfair competition, that large companies can use their resources, which is, in fact, if you want to be honest, one of the best examples of that is Amazon. Amazon basically copies other people's strategies and drives them out of business. Mm. So there is that issue to be concerned about. But on the other hand, what you're also concerned about is disruptions. You've got this really great balancing act. You want to pay a lower price? Good. Are you going to get the same quality product? If not, you're going to pay more, in the sense that if you buy something cheaper from, let's say, China, and it comes in and it's not as good quality, that's going to be put into the car. The car is going to be taken out, and guess what's going to happen? It'll break down.
Mm-hmm.
Guess who's going to be charged with the warranty costs? You will be.
Mm-hmm.
You have a problem. So you're balancing the quality, the disruption, the price. You're also balancing the fact that you want to maintain a diverse supply chain. Why? Because you don't want it to be dependent on only a few suppliers. Because if those suppliers have a hiccup, you have a problem.
Professor,
so you've got the issue.
Let me take a break right here. I could do this for 8 hours, and I hope you come back because there are so many layers to this. And
of course,
man, I love when you correct me because I'm trying to learn here. And I'm trying to instruct the. I'm trying to let the audience help the audience learn about all this. When we come back, I want to talk about the United States being able to compete with other countries where the government actually subsidizes the manufacturing process, right? That happens. And I also want to look ahead to what happens with the auto industry 3 months from now, because I'm a little bit confused. We're going to have tariffs to bring back manufacturing, and the auto industry said, no, that's going to kill us. So the president said, all right, no tariffs for 3 months. What happens then? Because this is major industry. This is I don't understand how you can have any. I wouldn't run a convenience store with this type of uncertainty. I don't know how you can run an auto industry like this as far as supply chain tariffs, et cetera. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Stephen Melnick, 937, 23 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. All right, 9:45, quickly back to Stephen Melnick, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. Professor, we could almost do this once a week about tariffs because it's very complicated. Yep. Somebody texted in, and I've already used the phrase tariff hold'em. It seems like that's what we're doing here. But who has the cards? Because somebody texted in and said there's no way either Canada or Mexico could stand up to the economy of the United States when it comes to tariffs. You would say what to that?
I would say that you're starting to see changes in both Canada and the United States in terms of relationships. Right now, Canada is exploring relationships with the EU because of the minerals. And Canada is doing some interesting things. Let me give you, you're right. You know, given the fact how intertwined the economy, you could say that's going to take place. But if you're starting to see a response which is beyond economic in Canada. And I should know that because I'm a dual citizen. I'm originally from Canada. I'm an American. I'm what we call a Canucian. And what you're starting to see is provinces like Ontario have taken a really hard stance, and they're saying this: you cannot jerk us around. We're gonna put tariffs not only on, things such as the energy, which Michigan, Ohio, New York, Maine, Massachusetts uses. We're also going to do things like ban liquor. So, for example, bourbon, which comes from Tennessee and Kentucky. Ontario's pulled them off its shelves. They're also looking at access to critical minerals. For example, you need things like iron ore, nickel, uranium. Canada is one of the major suppliers. And what's happening now is Canada's saying, okay, fine, if you want to play that game, we're going to explore opportunities with the EU because the EU represents a viable alternative, but that takes time. But the issue that I think you're also bringing up that the person at the other end got to realize is Canada, the United States, and Mexico have developed a relationship. And because we've developed a relationship, we've developed the act of working together. Do you want to convert a relationship where there's goodwill and trust into one where it's strictly transactional, where we look at everything and say, guess what? It's based on how much you bring to the table. I would argue that that view is short-sighted. And why is it short-sighted? Because in the auto industry, let's establish something. How much do you think the auto industry contributes to the United States economy? Mm. Take a guess.
I don't even know how to start, Professor. Percentage or dollars? Tell me.
Okay, it's $1.2 trillion a year.
Wow.
Or 5% of our, and that's directly. It doesn't pick up indirect effects. The businesses, this maintenance, the people who service. Right now, if you're an American, if you're in the United States, my biggest concern, if I'm in the auto industry, is China. Now, why China? Because you were picking it up before the break. Mm-hmm. China has benefited from a directed economy. The Chinese government has understood the lessons of the past, which is the best time to disrupt a dominant competitor is when the technology changes. I'll give you an example. Do you remember years ago there was a product called Word Perfect and word processing?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Everyone had to use WordPerfect. Now, that was because this was when you had a screen and you had to put in the codes and you could go back and forth between the screen and what the document would look like formatted. A company called Microsoft, small little company, is looking at this, and WordPerfect is dominant. It has the major percentage. So Windows comes up. What does Windows do? It gives a graphic interface. What you see is what you get. And so instead of tacking WordPerfect and saying, we're going to give you something in the existing, it waited until the graphics interface took place and said, we'll give you a word processor that works in that environment. WordPerfect had a problem. How do I respond by keeping my existing, without losing my existing users and attracting a new? It had difficulty. Now what's happened? Microsoft Word is the major word processor. The Chinese are looking at the industry and saying, where are we going? We're going to EVs. So they've encouraged massive investment in EVs in China. And if you want to see what it's going to be like if we don't have a joint unified strategy to deal with China, just look at Australia. Their auto industry is dominated by Chinese cars. And why? Because the Chinese have an interesting strategy of what they do is they come in from the bottom. And you can see that right now in the cars that they're showing in Los Angeles to many of the car influencers. These are cars under $30,000, $50,000, phenomenally technologically advanced, high quality, with better feature than many of the EVs we have in the United States. So if I'm in the auto industry, I need to work with Canada, Mexico, and with the manufacturers in the United States so we can put together a unified strategy so we can meet the Chinese and offer the consumer a fairly priced car that they can use. The tariffs are causing Americans, Canadians, and Mexicans to become adversaries. And that's the worst thing to do.
So here's what I'm thinking from what you're saying. We only have a couple of minutes left, Professor, and you have to come back. But what my concern is that somehow we encourage Mexico, Canada, and the EU to start doing more business with China, and somehow the United States winds up the odd fellow out. Is that
That's a real possibility. And let me give you just an example of where that's really becoming an issue. Again, when you talk with me, you know a straight line is a curve. Mm-hmm. Right now in the NATO, the dominant standard for military warfare is American. Mm-hmm. And if one of our major exporters in terms of the surplus, in terms of the balance of trade balances, is the defense industry. We're now starting to see Poland, Norway, Finland, Canada considering dropping the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. Why? Because they're concerned about two things. Number one, the United States is not committed to NATO. And number two, they're concerned about the fact that in this trade war environment, what's to prevent the Americans from saying, well, the F-35 strike fighter has American technology on information. We won't allow you to use that. That's what makes the F-35 so powerful. So now what you're starting to see is this whole series of actions has disrupted what previously was a fair, there were stresses. Let's not put it down. How many, the percentage of GDP that countries were using to support military. But the whole issue is China is a major force. We've got to do something as a country, and we need our partners to do that.
And real quick, before we let you go, I can't believe that countries with a proximity to the United States like Mexico and Canada, that we really want them to have a stronger relationship with the Chinese, do we?
No, we don't. In fact, we want to keep the Chinese out. And we don't want to keep the Chinese out by means of higher prices and tariffs. We want to keep the Chinese out by offering a superior product at a competitive price. That should be our goal. The consumer, not the stockholder, should benefit from our efforts.
Professor, thank you. Never enough time. We'll talk to you again soon because it is complicated stuff. Were that it were so simple to say, that's it, tariff done. We don't do business with you, but it's not the way it was back in the 1890s or 1913s. Thank you, sir. Stephen Melnick, professor of supply chain management, Michigan State, done research in the strategic supply chain, cybersecurity, performance measurement, supply chain design. I hope you can appreciate that for the apolitical discussion it was. I'm just trying to look at causes and effects here and processes as opposed to results. We'll take a break. Find out what Noel Norman's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.